Hey everyone, welcome to the Peter Attia Drive. I'm your host, Peter Attia. The drive is a result of my hunger for optimizing performance, health, longevity, critical thinking, along with a few other obsessions along the way. I've spent the last several years working with some of the most successful, top-performing individuals in the world, and this podcast is my attempt to synthesize what I've learned along the way to help you live a higher quality, more fulfilling life. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at peterattiamd.com. Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of The Drive. I'd like to take a couple of minutes to talk about why we don't run ads on this podcast and why instead we've chosen to rely entirely on listener support. If you're listening to this, you probably already know, but the two things I care most about professionally are how to live longer and how to live better. I have a complete fascination and obsession with this topic. I practice it professionally, and I've seen firsthand how access to information is basically all people need to make better decisions and improve the quality of their lives. Curating and sharing this knowledge is not easy, and even before starting the podcast, that became clear to me. The sheer volume of material published in this space is overwhelming. I'm fortunate to have a great team that helps me continue learning and sharing this information with you. To take one example, our show notes are in a league of their own. In fact, we now have a full-time person that is dedicated to producing those, and the feedback has mirrored this. So all of this raises a natural question. How will we continue to fund the work necessary to support this? As you probably know, the tried and true way to do this is to sell ads. But after a lot of contemplation, that model just doesn't feel right to me for a few reasons. Now, the first and most important of these is trust. I'm not sure how you could trust me if I'm telling you about something when you know I'm being paid by the company that makes it to tell you about it. Another reason selling ads doesn't feel right to me is because I just know myself. I have a really hard time advocating for something that I'm not absolutely nuts for. So if I don't feel that way about something, I don't know how I can talk about it enthusiastically. So instead of selling ads, I've chosen to do what a handful of others have proved can work over time, and that is to create a subscriber support model for my audience. This keeps my relationship with you both simple and honest. If you value what I'm doing, you can become a member and support us at whatever level works for you. In exchange, you'll get the benefits above and beyond what's available for free. It's that simple. It's my goal to ensure that no matter what level you choose to support us at, you will get back more than you give. So, for example, members will receive full access to the exclusive show notes, including other things that we plan to build upon, such as the downloadable transcripts for each episode. These are useful beyond just the podcast, especially given the technical nature of many of our shows. Members also get exclusive access to listen to and participate in the regular Ask Me Anything episodes. That means asking questions directly into the AMA portal and also getting to hear these podcasts when they come out. Lastly, and this is something I'm really excited about, I want my supporters to get the best deals possible on the products that I love. And as I said, we're not taking ad dollars from anyone, but instead what I'd like to do is work with companies who make the products that I already love and would already talk about for free and have them pass savings on to you. Again, the podcast will remain free to all, but my hope is that many of you will find enough value in one, the podcast itself, and two, the additional content exclusive for members to support us at a level that makes sense for you. I want to thank you for taking a moment to listen to this. If you learn from and find value in the content I produce, please consider supporting us directly by signing up for a monthly subscription. Welcome to the kickoff of this Matthew Walker three-part series on sleep. This is one of the topics we are asked about the most, and I think this will be a fan favorite. This series of podcasts will be released over 3 weeks, with this one being the first. Now, at the end of the series, we're going to take questions for a follow-up AMA with Matthew. Asking questions on the AMA forum and listening to the AMA podcast with Matthew, along with all AMAs, will only be available to subscribers. So if you haven't signed up yet, you can do so now at peterattiamd.com/subscribe. My guest this week is Matthew Walker, professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the founder and director of the Center for Human Sleep Science. Matthew earned his undergraduate degree and PhD in neurophysiology in London, and subsequently became a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School before moving to Berkeley. His research examines the impact of sleep on human brain function in healthy and diseased populations. To date, he has published over 100 scientific studies. He has received numerous funding awards from the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, and he's a fellow of the National Academy of Sciences. He's the author of the international bestseller, Why We Sleep, which also happens to be the favorite book of my not-yet-two-year-old son. He holds many patents covering various consumer-based sleep recordings, sleep tracking, and sleep simulation. He's a sleep scientist at Google, where he helps the scientific exploration of sleep in health and disease. He is also an enormous fan of Formula One and my hero, Ayrton Senna. And in the third part of this installment, we actually spend quite a bit of time discussing this. Here in the first part of this series, we discuss the relationship between sleep, dementia, and Alzheimer's disease, the four pillars of sleep, sleep stages, measurements, and the overall importance of sleep, the lack of sleep and dangers of drowsy driving, and how the conversation of sleep has changed over the past several years. So without further delay, here is the first installment of my three-part series with Professor Matthew Walker. Matt, thank you so much for making time to meet on a Sunday.
Absolute privilege and a delight to be with you, Peter.
What's with the weather in Berkeley? Is it always this bad?
Now, when Peter says, is it always this bad? It's probably in the low 60s and there isn't much blue sky. It's dry and there's a very pleasant breeze and there is some wonderful blossom. So I know it's not San Diego where everything is utopian and people are singing Kumbaya at the end of the day and holding hands, but it's a pretty good day when you consider it's still February.
Right. I know. It's like I live in these extremes. Like, in San Diego, the bar is like it has to be perfect. And then in New York, you just sort of expect it to be sort of, like I was there 2 days ago and it stunk.
But I mean, all three of those are best than the United Kingdom, my home country, where essentially you have 9 months of really bad weather and then 3 months of winter. And then that's your year. So this today, February, like this low 60s, I'm a happy man.
I came from Canada where it's bad in a different way. But the first time I saw California was my interview for med school. And it was a February day and it was 76 degrees. And that was the first time it occurred to me that you didn't have to suffer. I never realized. I mean, I guess intellectually I understood that it could be warm in the winter, but it never occurred to me that you could choose to do that. So, well, now speaking of this, so what brought you to the U.S.?
It was science. I did all of my education back in the United Kingdom. I actually started off at medical school. So back in the U.K. at age 18, you can actually go to medical school. It's a 5-year program. And after about 2 years, this wonderful professor came up and said, look, you're a nice guy, but you're always asking questions. And you're asking them, I think, genuinely. You're not asking them to be an arse. But I think you're actually a scientist, not a doctor. Because at the time, he was thinking, doctors are interested in answers. Scientists are interested in questions. I think you're a scientist, not a doctor. So we didn't have MD, PhD programs back at that time. So then, I thought about it for the summer, came back, switched to neuroscience. So essentially brain science, did that as an undergraduate, then went on to do my PhD at the Medical Research Council in London, and then came to Harvard for my first faculty position there. And I was there for 7 years as faculty in psychiatry at Harvard. And the winters just got to me and the environment at times as well, academic was perhaps more combative and competitive. And I think that's one way to breed productivity in a department, and I'm not shaking a finger at it. But by nature, I'm just a person who is much more collaborative and collegial rather than combative and competitive. So Berkeley fit my mentality better, came out here, weather was great. California, it's an immensely easy place to arrive and a very difficult place to leave. And I think I probably won't.
I know that feeling. I'm probably leaving California. I'm going through the mourning process of accepting the departure.
You'll be back.
It's a hard place to leave. When did the switch sort of flip in terms of your passion for sleep?
I think back at medical school, I was always interested in states of consciousness, I guess you would describe it as. I was fascinated by anesthesia. I was fascinated by even hypnosis. I remember I actually went out to meet this hypnotist to try and understand not, the act and the show. I wasn't interested in that. I fundamentally wanted to understand what did he think happened within the brain to produce this altered state of consciousness. So I got really interested in how the brain can switch between sort of states, mental states, and then just fundamental awareness states. That then naturally led me to just become fascinated by sleep. I mean, there is no better demonstration of a gigantic shift in conscious state that happens to almost every single living creature on this planet every 24 hours. And back then, this was 20 years ago, we had this fundamental question, why do we sleep? And what was staggering to me is that it took a third of our lives. Every species that we've studied to date does it, sleeps. It seems to have evolved with life itself on this planet. Even more, we've understood the functions of the other main biological drives, eating, drinking, and procreating, for tens, if not hundreds of years. But the fourth main biological drive, the drive to sleep, had continued to elude scientific judgment. How is that possible? And back then, 20 years ago, if someone were to ask you, you know, why do we sleep? The crass answer was, we sleep to cure sleepiness. And that's the fatuous equivalent of saying, well, we eat to cure hunger. Well, that tells you nothing about the fundamental nutritional benefits of macronutrition. But that's where we were at with sleep. So it was, for me, this perfect collision of a fascination in an innate biological problem and universal behavior conserved across evolution, together with the fact that we did it for a third of our lives, plus the fact that science had not been able to crack this nut. It was one of the last great remaining scientific mysteries. I thought, well, you know, if you want to pick something that's going to sustain you for the rest of your life, and some of the most acerbic, brilliant minds in science had tried to crack this nut and failed, including Francis Crick, wonderful scientist who discovered the helical structure of DNA, it's unlikely I'm going to do it in my lifetime, but at least it will sustain me as a problem. And I could not let it go. And so that was where the intellectual bite happened. The data, the empirical scientific bite happened when I was doing my PhD. I was studying brainwave patterns in people with dementia, and I was trying to do differential diagnosis very early on in the course of cognitive decline, seeing which type of dementia did they have. Was it frontal lobe dementia? Was it Lewy body dementia? Was it Alzheimer's dementia? And I was failing miserably for 2 years. I was getting nothing. I used to go home. I was living in this doctor's residence, and I had this sort of, in the middle of my room, this little igloo of journals that used to sit in on a Sunday, just this kind of like sort of sanctified circle of knowledge. And I was reading one Sunday, and I realized that the different pathologies in these different dementias, some would hit the sleep centers and others would leave those sleep centers completely untouched.
Even within forms of dementia that clinically presented very similarly.
That's right. Yeah, you could see certain brainstem nuclei, certain centers within the basic base of the brain. Some of those were getting eroded by the dementia, and those are sleep-generating centers. Whilst in other of those pathologies, those centers were spurred until very late in the disorder, so they probably weren't affecting my early patients. So I realized I was measuring their brainwave activity at the wrong time. I was measuring my patients whilst they were awake. What I should have been doing is measuring them whilst they were asleep, got a small grant, set up a sleep lab, learned how to do it, got some great results. And then the question became, if their sleep is so disrupted, is it not just a symptom of dementia? Could sleep disruption actually be a biomarker of dementia? Could it actually foretell when you are going to develop dementia and which type? Or even more profound, is sleep disruption an underlying cause of Alzheimer's disease? And I think right now, based on the weight of the data that we have, and we and others have got large research programs doing this work, the evidence, I think, is causal. I think that sleep at this stage may be one of the most significant lifestyle factors, at least, that determines your risk ratio for Alzheimer's disease. I feel the causal evidence for that now in humans and animals is strong enough to make that statement. And I don't make that statement lightly.
Yeah, that is profound, because when you think about the other really big ones, vascular disease and insulin resistance, they both feed into a very similar mechanism, which is neuronal energy deprivation.
That's right.
So do you think that sleep disruption or poor sleep. And I want to come back to the semantics around that because I don't actually think I'm well equipped to talk about this intelligently. But do you think that that also disrupts some aspect of energy metabolism in the brain? Or where in the sort of chain of events do you think that that impacts?
I think one of the places that it impacts is in oxidative stress. I think it's safe to say that wakefulness is low-level brain damage. And we need sleep to avert some of that low-level brain damage, that wakefulness. Sleep is the price that we pay for wakefulness, essentially. And, you know, something I mentioned in a book that I put out was, and I got a lot of
just a little book, just a little New York Times bestseller. Yeah. Which, by the way, before we're done, I brought my copy because my youngest son, who's named after our mutual favorite race car driver, loves moons. It's all he thinks about. moons, his pajamas, moons, everything. And he loves your book, except for the fact that on the inside, there are no pictures of moons. So he'll sit there and he'll look at the cover and he'll go, moo, moo, moo. And then he flips through it and he gets so frustrated that there's no moon pictures inside.
I will course correct that if there's a second edition. and I will just try to place the words underneath that it is for the benefit of Ayrton.
Yes.
But in the book, you know, I proposed that we didn't evolve sleep, that perhaps we've got it the wrong way around. Perhaps the default state of life on the planet was sleep. And it was from sleep that wakefulness emerged.
Wow.
Why could it not have been that way? Now, I don't have any good evidence to support my hypothesis. I think it could be utter nonsense. But I think it's a tenable hypothesis. It's just one that's difficult to test. But to come back to your question about Alzheimer's, which I think is critical, I think the first thing is that we see that with insufficient sleep, you get increases in oxidative stress. Those oxidative stress processes lead to a whole cascade of kind of a finger flick domino effect of things that lead to neuronal death. One of the areas in the brain that is most sensitive to that is an area that we call the hippocampus, which is a critical memory center. It's probably one of the first structures to undergo damage in Alzheimer's disease. It's part of the reason why the sort of the phenotype of Alzheimer's is forgetfulness, problems with memory. I think perhaps the stronger evidence, though, in terms of sleep and Alzheimer's disease risk is a remarkable discovery that was made probably about 5 or 6 years ago now by some folks at Rochester University in rats. And what they discovered is that the brain actually has a sewage system inside of it. Now, your body has one that you're all familiar with called the lymphatic system. But it turns out the brain has one. It's called the glymphatic system, named after the cells in the brain that form this system called the glial cells, also known by sort of from a Greek derivative meaning glue. So they used to be just thought as the sort of the cells.
The sort of irrelevant stuff between the neurons.
Exactly. You know, yeah, it was like junk DNA. And of course, what we always learn is that Mother Nature is far too efficient to leave inefficiency on the table, like glue or junk. And it turns out they form this sanitization system within the brain. And what happens, they discovered, is that when you go into deep sleep at night, this sewage system kicks into high gear. And essentially those glial cells, which surround the brain cells themselves, the neurons proper, they shrink in size by up to 200%. And then all of a sudden it leaves a vast amount of room for cerebrospinal fluid to start perfusing the brain and washing out the metabolic detritus of wakefulness. So it would be like New York City at night, all of the buildings shrunk down to 200%. You know, they became miniaturized. And then there was this big effluent flush that just happened across Manhattan to clear out all the debris. And it's essentially good night, sleep clean, that you get this power cleanse at night. Why is this related to Alzheimer's? Well, one of the critical ingredients that they found that the glymphatic system washed away was a sticky toxic protein called beta amyloid. Beta amyloid is probably one of the two core proteins that we know underlie your risk for the development of Alzheimer's. Ergo, if you're not getting your sleep at night, you're not getting that washing away of the toxic Alzheimer's protein. every night, then you are building up more amyloid within the brain. If you keep doing that night after night, it's like compounding interest on a loan. It's just escalating your Alzheimer's risk. That's why we can then explain the associational evidence, which I don't like associational evidence in epidemiological studies, and I don't think you're a huge fan of it, perhaps, either.
Just don't tell anybody at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Yeah, or maybe the NIH when I'm applying for grants for epidemiological studies. But what we certainly see is that if you bucket people into the amount of sleep on average that they've got across the lifespan, and at the end of the sort of life or in late life in their 70s and their 80s, we do a special type of PET scan to map the amount of amyloid in their brain. And then you just sort of look at those brain scans. Anyone on the street would not need any statistics. They would not need any training in brain science to see that one of these maps is different to the other. It's like Sesame Street. And what is remarkable is people who are getting, you know, 7 hours of sleep or less compared to 7 hours of sleep or more, there is marked differences in the amount of amyloid that's built up. Now, that's just associational evidence. But then when you take it down to the level of animal studies, where they selectively deprive animals of either deep non-REM sleep or they fragment their sleep, you get an immediate amyloid buildup centrally within the brain. You start to have what looks like a sort of, you know, an amyloid sort of genic process that's happening. That's rats. So then we can all wave our hands if we want, because we would like to beat our chests and sort of, you know, say, I don't need my sleep, and that's just rat stuff. Well, the studies have now been done in humans, where we will take a human being, and for one single night, we will take away their deep sleep. And the way that you do that is that you just play these auditory tones at night. So they never wake up. So the total amount of sleep that they get is still 8 hours, but I can just selectively excise your deep sleep when that sewage system should be kicking into gear. And then the next day, we do something that's really rather unpleasant. We do a spinal cord puncture, and we suck out some cerebrospinal fluid, and we can measure the amount of the two toxic proteins linked to Alzheimer's. One is called beta amyloid that we've discussed. The other is called tau protein. And we see the next day, after one night of sleep disruption, a significant increase in circulating levels of amyloid and tau. For me, that was kind of like the turning point where I finally felt comfortable going on record and saying, at this point, folks, I really feel comfortable saying that your sleep is a critical component of your prevention of Alzheimer's disease. I really think the evidence is now, you know, in that direction and way in that direction. It's not just epidemiological. It's not just prospective longitudinal studies, which are better than cross-sectional sort of epidemiological. It's not just causal in rats. It's experimentally causal in humans after one night of sleep.
Do you see variation there? Because one of the things that I find difficult with understanding all diseases and Alzheimer's would be sort of more so than even cardiovascular disease, because we still have so much less data, is there must clearly be enough variation between people that it's very easy at the heterogeneous level to miss things that you would see in an otherwise homogeneous population. So for example, when you look at the coinage of the term Alzheimer's disease, it's quite likely that that was coined based on a patient who probably had a PSEN1 or 2 mutation, such an early onset of the disease, yeah, versus the disease we typically see. I mean, today those patients make up less than 1%. And it's almost a different disease from the, you know, these are people that are presenting in their 50s and they're usually dead before they're 60. Whereas 99% of the population are getting a sort of later onset disease. And even, of course, then within that population, all of the variation with ApoE genotype, it almost makes you wonder if there's different susceptibilities to this deprivation, because everybody and their brother can point to the exceptions to these rules, right? The person who did everything right, slept like a baby every night, and ends up down this one path. And then, of course, the person who does everything incorrect and seems to be, you know, completely fine, at least from the perspective of, you know, no obvious disease. So your analogy is really interesting, because I don't really find myself hugely in the amyloid beta camp as the main causal driver. I think it's more of a result. But it's interesting what you posit is, if it's more about the clearance of that than the generation of that, that would be a congruent view with this idea that, you know, there could be other things on the back end that are driving this primarily. But of course, I think with Alzheimer's disease, it strikes me as just so complicated because of the genetic predisposition coupled with the multiple pathways that can seem to drive comparable insults to an otherwise incredibly sensitive organ.
I hugely cleave to the idea that probably what we call Alzheimer's right now is going to be subtyped at some point in the future that we'll
have. Imagine it's like cancer, right? Where in 30 years, hopefully the rate of growth has slowed, that it's not, you know, a pandemic, but you might have five subtypes or something for that.
That's right. You know, and I think we will see that. I think, and then we will start to pattern match what features. I think the fact that sleep already, let's just call Alzheimer's disease this strange heterogeneous sort of mix right now that we feel uncomfortable about in terms of pinning one exact pathological ingredient as the causal trigger for that. In fact, I actually probably think tau is, if you look at the data,
I think the data are better for tau than amyloid
in terms of predicting cognitive decline, at least, than amyloid is. But the fact that, you know, we've now found that insufficient sleep will also lead to tau aggregation too, I think, is concerning and worrying. But let's accept that this Alzheimer's thing, this disease state, is heterogeneous. The fact that sleep, and we can find such a strong predictive sleep signal in terms of that risk, despite it being such a diffuse gray matter ball itself of a disease, must mean that the links between insufficient sleep and this heterogeneous thing are, I think, probably quite strong. Otherwise, the dirtiness of the equation would be such that those associations would be far weaker rather than stronger. The fact that they're already present leads me to believe that when we do eventually subtype Alzheimer's disease, we will then find that there are subsets of sleep features that are deterministic of those subsets of Alzheimer's. So, for example, deep sleep will be predictive of one form of Alzheimer's. Sleep fragmentation, which is more about sleep quality than it is about physiological quantity, you know, sleep fragmentation will be predictive of something else, another sort of subtype of Alzheimer's disease. Then I think, you know, basic
duration could matter.
I think there probably are four pillars of sleep. There is probably regularity. How consistent is your sleep schedule? Are you undergoing what we call social jet lag, which is where you're bouncing around, you're going to sleep at, you know, 1 a.m., then 10 p.m. and all over the map. So there's sort of regularity. There is the continuity of your sleep. Is it fragmented? Are you waking up many more times, or is it just nice one long shot? That's a second feature. I think the third feature is quantity. How much sleep are you getting, and how much of the different stages of you are you getting? And then independent of how regular your sleep is, how continuous your sleep is, and the amount, the quantity, the final is quality. And quality has come big in the last 5 years in the sleep field. In other words, what is the electrical signature of your sleep? And just because you're getting 8 hours of sleep doesn't mean that you're getting 8 hours of good electrical quality deep sleep. And, you know, I hope that we get the chance to speak about sort of things like caffeine and alcohol, other substances of abuse that can make you feel like you're sleeping 8 hours. But so quantity, just fine. Quality, poor. So to come back to your question, I love the way that you think about that problem, and I agree with it very much that Alzheimer's disease is probably going to be heterogeneous. I think the pathology already points to that and its complexity. The way that sleep plugs into that heterogeneous disorder that we call Alzheimer's is also going to be heterogeneous in nature. Different sleep features will be predictive of different aspects of the amyloid pathology cascade. And we just submitted a paper, which I'm going to blow now in terms of media sort of outlet, which hasn't been accepted yet. But we just tried to ask the question, across someone's lifespan, if you bucket them into 10-year decades and you ask, what was the quantity and quality of their sleep from their 30s and 40s, 40s and 50s, 50s and 60s, so on and so forth. And then at the end of their life, you stick them in a brain scanner and you map how much amyloid is in the brain and how much tau is in the brain, which is what we can do here at the sleep center. And then you essentially can, in a retrospective manner, say, was sleep at certain times of life more critical in predicting how much amyloid you will have late in life? So in other words, are there certain decades during an adult's lifespan where sleep is even more important for determining your...
How can you do that retrospectively? So let's say you had this cohort of patients. Maybe at best you could, through questionnaires, infer duration, but how would you be able to infer anything about depth or quality?
So depth we can't do, but quality we can do. So we've got a set of standardized questionnaires that have been essentially validated against gold standard, what we call polysomnography, which essentially is sleep laboratory grade recording with electrodes. And what we find is that those questionnaires have good predictive validity relative to objective gold standard measures. So it's a hop, skip, and a jump, but you can say, look, these subjective questionnaires seem to go pretty well hand in hand with sleep quantity and quality. Let's take those questionnaires and then let's ask of those patients what they were doing in terms of their sleep quantity and quality in those different bucket decades of their life. And it has all of the problems that you can imagine.
Yeah, because this seems like a slightly better version of a food frequency questionnaire, which your peers would be relying on to do the same question,
right,
about
exactly.
Nutrition.
So yeah. It's reliant on an individual. You know, it's got problems with history because, you know, the further you go back, does that signal of accuracy degrade?
How big are the hazard ratios? Because I guess this is where one of those things where if sleep could account for 25% of this disease, or if it increased the risk by, say, 25% would be a better way to say that, it strikes me as unlikely that you could see that signal, because that's not a big enough signal with all the noise you've just described. But if you were talking about a hazard ratio of 6 or 7, or, you know, it's so funny, today one of my kids asked me about smoking, like, why do people smoke? And this, I couldn't resist going down the Bradford Hill pathway of, unfortunately, he's 4.5, but he got probably about a 12-minute lecture on epidemiology and the hazard ratio of small cell lung cancer and smoking. But the punchline of my story to him...
Peter Attia, ladies and gentlemen, Peter Attia. Yeah.
I was trying to explain to him what it would mean to have a 14x increase in risk, which was basically what was observed in the first physician study of smoking. And, you know, the point there is that is such a massive signal that, I mean, as you describe it, I love... Whenever you can get these things, it's statistics that aren't necessary. When you don't need the p-value to figure it out, that's it. So does your intuition, and if, again, I don't want you to scoop what's already in this paper, so if you can't speak about it, no problem. But do you have a sense of that magnitude, and therefore if even a crude backwards-looking metric is directionally pointing you at something that you think, wow, this isn't a subtle change?
Yeah, I mean, we're up in the region of, you know, from 0.45 to 0.6. So it's, you know, it's...
In risk reduction for those doing it correctly.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. So it's substantial. But what was interesting to me, which gave me more confidence, was that the windows of sleep sensitivity were... Now, by the way, across the entire lifespan, if you're getting less sleep at almost any point in the lifespan, the risk that you're going to have higher amounts of these Alzheimer's disease proteins in your brain is greater. That's what we find across the board. But what's interesting is that when it comes to those two different proteins, amyloid and tau, there are different decades that are predictive. So if it's just one global subjective bias in your questionnaire, that you shouldn't see that result. So there is a sensitivity and specificity to these two different proteins that, to me, got me more excited that it transcended some of the limitations that are inherent in this approach. And also the fact that for amyloid, you get a very strong predictive signal, you know, 30s to 40s, and then again, sort of 60s to 70s. And for tau, it's actually somewhere in sort of the, starts in the 50s to 60s and then goes through until the 80s.
So what
in
about
terms of
childhood?
80 years old. So we didn't go back in terms of childhood, just because at that point, it's really difficult to feel confident about that data. You'd have to get parents who are not living at that stage. But to me, I think the fact that you got these strange kind of
you described a bimodal distribution for amyloid beta.
For amyloid, yeah. Which then lends me to believe that that result is difficult to explain by sort of just general memory biases, which would be kind of more of a linear approach. But I think the point is that, you know, the evidence that continues to build in favor of this story that insufficient sleep is a significant lifestyle factor in your deterministic ratio odds of developing Alzheimer's disease is ever stronger now. And the fact that, unlike many of the other lifestyle factors, the mechanism underlying it has now been demonstrated causally in humans and adults, and it's been done so acutely within a 24-hour period of time, that to me just knocked me sideways.
And the controls did not have, so if you controlled for everything except the perturbation, you didn't see the amyloid or tau rise
That's
in the
right.
controls.
Yeah.
See, this is kind of interesting too, because one of the reasons I've been a little less excited about amyloid. There's two reasons. One is what can only be, I think, described as just the abject failure of the pharmacologic approach to amyloid reduction. At our last counting, oh, I don't want to be misquoted on this. We'll include it in the show notes what the actual number is, but it's basically one amyloid antibody quasi-success at disease stabilization to the tune of 2,000 failures. That's one thing. The second is the autopsy studies of people who died without any clinical evidence of Alzheimer's disease who still have amyloid, making me wonder if amyloid is necessary but not sufficient. Yeah. And therefore, what if there's something else going on? And of course, the third thing I would now add, just based on thinking about it for 2 seconds, so this might not be well thought out, is in the next couple of hours, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of other things that sleep does that are in and of themselves completely devastating to your health, that also would feed into that. For example, the impact that negative sleep has on cardiovascular disease. And it's become quite clear that if you're doing bad things to your heart, you're doing bad things to your brain. And of course, we're going to talk about glucose disposal, hyperinsulinemia, and all of those things, which also have a clear impact. So I think this would only strengthen the case that sleep deprivation is bad for you and bad for your brain. To me, makes it harder to tease out potentially the mechanistic links, although there's no reason, as you said, that it can't be multifaceted.
Yeah, and I think there are certainly those conundrums where you see patients with non-trivial amounts of amyloid in the brain, let's say at postmortem, who are even only in the early stages of MCI, of what we call mild cognitive impairment. They haven't transitioned yet to
Alzheimer's
disease.
I'm glad you remember to explain these things, because I'm nodding away like, yeah, of course I know what MCI is. So, yeah.
But that aside, I think the idea that it's necessary, maybe not sufficient, but necessary, if you truly don't want necessary in your life, yeah. And if you're getting insufficient sleep, you're placing a necessary there where it doesn't necessarily have to be.
No, the analogy could be with lipoproteins. You know, there's a...
Oh, that's a very, yeah.
Right? I mean, yep. Lipoproteins are absolutely necessary but not sufficient for atherosclerosis. And so some people say, well, there's no efficacy in reducing lipoproteins. And I think part of it is it's diffuse, right? You're only tackling one of the four constitutive elements. Four things have to happen for you to get atherosclerosis, the lipoproteins being one. So that's actually an interesting idea. And it's a great argument for why would you want something that's necessary but not sufficient there? Why would you decrease your odds?
Yeah, I mean, you know, think about it like this. If your goal, the two most feared diseases in developed nations right now, I believe, are cancer and Alzheimer's disease.
And I would say it's in the other order.
And yeah, and I think Alzheimer's is you know, top of the list there. Do you want to de-risk the probability of Alzheimer's disease in your life? If you truly don't want to invite right to, you know, this thing called Alzheimer's disease and invite it in the mail coming at you, but you're getting, you know, less than 7 hours of sleep a night, you're not working in the direction that you wish. You're going against Alzheimer's disease prevention and you're working well towards Alzheimer's invitation. People will often say, you know, how much sleep do you get? And I'll say, look, I give myself a non-negotiable 8-hour sleep opportunity. And that's not because I'm trying to practice what I preach. I don't want to be some poster child for sleep. If you understood what I knew about sleep and all-cause mortality, as well as most disease processes, you would realize that I am being nothing short of utterly selfish in my preservation of an 8-hour sleep opportunity. I don't want to die young, and I don't want sickness and disease in my life. My family, for example, has got a very strong history of cardiovascular disease. And we know that deep sleep is probably the best form of blood pressure medication that you could ever wish for.
That would be an easier one to study. I'm guessing we'll come to that later.
Yeah,
the ability to perturb deep sleep and then see the change in
the
blood
consequence.
Pressure.
Yeah. I think the point is, I think I've bashed people over the head with this sufficiently, but the link between a lack of sleep and Alzheimer's now, I think, is very strong. And what I find, though, positive about that is with Alzheimer's disease, just as you mentioned, when it comes to pharmacological approaches, we just don't have anything that looks robust right now. So medicine in many ways, and especially for Alzheimer's disease, has started to shift from a model of late stage treatment to early stage prevention. And I think I feel very comfortable saying that one of the best preventative actions that you can take on the basis of the science right now is start to capitalize on your sleep at night.
So let's shift gears just a little bit and go back to the polysom. Let's explain to people, because we're going to eventually have to talk about tracking these things, and I want to bring up some of the sort of commercially available ways that people do that, which I think by definition are still not accurate enough for people to, you know, compare them to their polysom. But if I came into your lab tonight and I was willing to go to sleep there and you would hook me up to an EEG, what are the different patterns of brain waves and how would you morphologically describe them and then bucket them by these stages? You've already sort of touched on a little bit as deep REM, deep REM, deep non-REM, et cetera.
Yeah. So upon falling asleep, human beings, and in fact, all mammals, will experience two different stages of sleep. One of them is called non-rapid eye movement sleep. The other is rapid eye movement sleep. Non-REM sleep has been further subdivided into four separate stages, which are unimaginatively called stages 1 through 4.
Thank God.
Yeah, I know. I think that's all that the sleep-deprived people who are, you know, experimenting could come up with at that time. So increasing in their depth of sleep. So stages 3 and 4 of non-REM sleep are the really deep restorative stages of sleep. Stages